It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer. Coming up, we'll hear from Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson about the successful effort to bring the 2024 Republican National Convention to that city and hear his thoughts about some criticism of that decision. Now, do you ever feel like there's an author whose work you feel like you should read, but you just don't know where to start? Maybe it's because they're super prolific, like Joyce Carol Oates, and you're having trouble knowing which books are worth your time. Maybe they're intimidating, known for their genius, like Toni Morrison, or they're a super important author in a genre you're not used to, like maybe Octavia Butler, a science fiction legend. It'd be hard to know what to read. Our next guest has an idea to help you out with memes. Fauzi Taylor is the social media and marketing manager at a Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison and was recently featured in the New York Times for memes that help people navigate difficult authors or just decide what to read next. Fauzi, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I'm guessing this is the kind of question you get a lot in a bookstore. I want to get into author X. I don't know where to start. Help. How common is that scenario?
Oh, it's daily. It's a daily question.
And when you started making these flowcharts for a few different authors, how did you tackle this?
Well, I started with the James Baldwin flowchart. That was the first one I had made. I had made a display for him at the bookstore for his birthday, which was in early August. And I had realized that after a few days, it hadn't been touched. The display was completely unmoved. And I was heartbroken as somebody who really, really loves his work, and I'm grateful for his legacy. And I just assumed it was because folks felt intimidated and overwhelmed. And so I made the flowchart, and thinking I would just put it up by the display, but put it on the internet as well, and it went viral.
Talk about how you broke down. And this, speaking of authors who've written a lot, James Baldwin has written a lot. How did you break down, I guess, the mood people were coming in with to help them figure out where to start with an author like James Baldwin?
Well, I think first you have to figure out if you want fiction or nonfiction. And from that point, you know, we can get into titles, but the first breakdown of the flowchart is fiction or nonfiction. And then the choices are, I want to be happy, and that leads to go read a different author. I want to cry a little, and that leads to If Beale Street Could Talk, or I want to sob, which leads to Giovanni's Room. And then there's four choices over on nonfiction, which lead to essay collections that are a few of my favorites. These are all the books that I generally hand sell to customers when they come in and they're even remotely interested in reading James Baldwin. I think that these are great examples of his ability as a writer and as a critic, and are good places to start, knowing that there's so much more after that that you're going to get to read if you like it.
And once you put the viral meme online and that chart in the store, did people start picking up books off that display?
Yeah, it's been really nice. We've sold a lot of him in the store recently, and even more affecting. People have been sending photos of, you know, The Fire Next Time or Giovanni's Room that they've just picked up because of these flow charts and saying, this is my first James Baldwin. I'm so excited. Like, here are my thoughts. And as somebody who loves his work, there's really nothing better than that.
How valuable is it to not have just like a one size fits all, like, oh, you want author X, you got to read this one book first?
Yeah, I think you have to be a nerd about a specific writer and to know a little like the breadth of their work, to know where someone can find their window into their work. Not everyone's going to want to sit down and read The Price of the Ticket, which is almost all of his collected nonfiction. Someone that could be really intimidating. For some others, it's going to be a great pick because they don't want to have to pick just one essay. I think you really have to be a nerd. I think that whatever you want to read, whether it's Toni Morrison or Octavia Butler whatever you're trying to get into, queer science fiction, you just have to find somebody who's really passionate about it, whether it's online or at the library or your local bookstore.
Now, I'm thinking about what you've done here. I'd be pretty intimidated because I think, you know, I read a lot, but I don't think I know anybody's work all the way across the board enough, you know, unless they only wrote one book, to be able to do this. How did you set the bar for yourself in deciding which authors you could do these charts for?
Really, the charts reflect our expertise as a team at A Room of One's Own. There are a few that I made and curated personally, which are like the James Baldwin one, the abolitionist one, but the Toni Morrison one, my coworker Anita helped me with, the queer science fiction and fantasy one, Gretchen helped me with, the romance and feminist fiction Sid helped me with. So we're really only able to make charts that reflect the things that we really like to nerd out on.
I learned from that New York Times piece that I mentioned, not only did some of your charts go viral, the idea of making these flowcharts did, and some other people now have picked it up and tackled different authors or different genres. Was that exciting for you to see the concept go viral?
Yeah, it was. It's really cool. Whatever makes reading more exciting for folks, I'm really into. And also, there have been a lot of librarians and teachers who have reached out being like, this is such a good idea for a project to do with my students. Do you mind if we do it? And I'm just like, oh my, yes, please, please. And show us what they come up with, you know? It's a good, yeah.
And before I let you go, let's flip things around. Is there an author out there or a genre where you wish someone else would make a chart to help you decide what to read next?
Ooh. You know, I need to read more Toni Morrison. So I'm actually going to be using the Toni Morrison chart that my coworker helped me make to read more of her. So I'll be putting it to use.
Fozzie, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Fozzie Taylor is the social media and marketing manager at A Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison. They talked to us about flowchart memes that they and colleagues make that help people decide what to read, especially for authors who have written a lot. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of the man behind an action hero.
You know the action movie character John Wick, the assassin who avenges the death of his dog? Well, did you know the real John Wick lives in Wisconsin? Matt Geiger introduces us to him.
I'm sitting in a roadside diner in Reno when John Wick walks through the door. The John Wick. The John Wick you may be better acquainted with is an assassin in a black suit with matching hair and beard. Over the course of three movies, he has killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 bad guys. Played by an earnest Keanu Reeves, he uses a pencil and a dusty book of Russian fairy tales, among other things, as lethal weapons.
People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Of course, on the other hand...
Back in the diner, the man next to me is 96, deaf, and uses a walker to get around. He eats here 6 days a week, and shortly after he arrives, a tall glass of cold milk and a bowl brimming with fruit are placed on the table in front of him. Wick has lived in Mazamani since 1955. He wears a wedding ring in remembrance of Helen, the woman he married in 1947. How did this John Wick in the movie John Wick come to share a name? The answer is screenwriter Derek Kolstad, who happens to be the real John Wick's grandson.
And he wrote a movie called Scorn. And in that movie, he named the assassin John Wick for his grandfather, and the assassin's wife, Helen, for his grandmother. It was Keanu Reeves who, in a desire to create a series of movies, who removed the name Scorn and gave it the name John Wick.
So what does he think of the movies that bear his name and have racked up more than $500 million at the global box office?
No, I haven't seen them. And Derek knows I haven't seen them. I don't go to movies because I can't hear them. I don't have television because I can't hear it.
Despite not seeing or hearing them, he has enjoyed their success.
Oh, yeah. That's been fun. I've enjoyed that. Yeah.
In the movies, Wick fights against villains who killed a puppy that was a gift from his recently deceased wife.
When Helen died, I lost everything. Until that dog arrived on my doorstep. And your son took that from me.
As I sit here with Mr. Wick, it occurs to me just how important the real Helen, who died 5 years ago, is. The real John Wick grew up on a farm, joined the U.S. Navy, and had a long career in construction. He proudly points out the size of his family, his clan, as he calls them, which includes 58 people. Despite all the fun and outlandish aesthetics and action of the films, perhaps what makes these stories so popular is how they capture the bond between two people. When someone we love is taken in real life, usually simply by time rather than assassins, we are left to go on without them. But we refuse. We hold on, and in our memories, in the stories we tell, we keep them here in our world just a little longer.
Over the years, Helen and I often went into Madison to eat and go to a movie. Just the two of us, not with the kids.
John Wick's grandson told a story that's been seen and heard by millions of people. Here in Grandma Mary's diner, surrounded by clattering dishes and far from Hollywood, the original John Wick tells his own story. Not of the movies that bear his name, but of the films he used to see all those years ago, and the person with whom he saw them.
Writer Matt Geiger brought us that story on the real John Wick. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the mayor of Milwaukee joins the show to talk about the Republican National Convention coming to the city in 2 years and how local leaders and businesses are getting ready. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The city of Milwaukee is getting ready to host the Republican National Convention in 2024. That decision was made official earlier this month. That's after the 2020 Democratic Convention in Milwaukee was dramatically dialed back because of the pandemic. Local officials and business leaders are celebrating the potential economic impact for the city. A coalition of activist groups has criticized the news, saying the benefits aren't likely to help Milwaukee's most underserved communities. Cavalier Johnson is the mayor of Milwaukee. Mayor Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
What were some of the things you think pushed Milwaukee over the top to bring the RNC in?
A couple of things. One is the bipartisan nature in which I approached landing the convention. Our partners, not just in the host committee, but in the business community, as well as the fact that Milwaukee's got a turnkey operation. We just won the Democratic National Convention for 2020, and although the convention did not play out as all of us would have hoped, I think that the Republican National Committee saw the value, not just in Milwaukee being selected by the DNC, but also the investments and the like that we had in place for that convention.
What work needs to be done now between now and that convention in 2024?
So we'll be working with our partners in a whole host of different levels. I mean, obviously, there's additional dollars that have to continue to be raised. The police department will be working with our partners in other levels of government. Other police departments are federal partners as well, including with the United States Secret Service. The host committee will be working with businesses, working to make sure that folks in our city have the opportunity to bid on, participate in the contracting opportunities with the RNC as well. So there's a lot of work that has to happen between now and when the convention takes place in our city in 2024.
What do you see as the potential economic benefit for Milwaukee?
I see the economic benefits as huge, not just for the convention, but for other large-scale events that will come after the convention is done. When the convention comes here, there's going to be millions and millions of dollars that are spent right here in our local economy, in our hotels, in our bars, in our restaurants, for the people who work in those facilities as well. Think about the busboys. Think about the maids and hotels. All those folks are going to see an interest in this. They're going to get some reward from the convention being in place here in Milwaukee. And then after it's over, because Milwaukee would be on the map for hosting a large-scale national political convention, the eyes of the country and the world be on the city, it'll open up the opportunity for us to attract some of those things that I mentioned before, whether it's the NBA All-Star Game, the MLB All-Star Game, the CrossFit Games, bringing back things like the U.S. Triathlon, things like that. WWE SummerSlam that I mentioned when we were in Chicago accepting this. We want to see all those sort of things take place here in the city, put Milwaukee on the map to attract those things and to have additional dollars spent on tourism and conventions here in the city.
Talking to Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson about the Republican National Committee coming to Milwaukee for the big convention in 2024. Mayor Johnson, one critique from some local organizations, Marquette University political scientist Phil Rocco as well, saying, hey, yeah, there's a lot of money going to change hands here. A lot of it will end up either going into, the state coffers via sales taxes or, hotel chains and things like that. Doesn't necessarily stay in Milwaukee, doesn't necessarily go where it's needed the most. What do you say to those concerns?
Well, we have a number of hoteliers who are based here in Milwaukee and don't have interests outside of the city or outside of the state. When you think about the Marcus Hotels and Resorts, they're based right here in Milwaukee. You've got other hoteliers who are present and on the ground and have operations right downtown in the epicenter of where the events are going to take place. Obviously, those folks who work in the food and beverage industry here in our city, they are based here and they will see the benefit. Their employees will also see the benefit directly without, you know, having to worry about some out-of-state firm that's involved here as well. So I think that a lot of folks, a lot of businesses, a lot of people who work for those businesses right here in the city will see a tremendous benefit from having the convention here in our town.
Now, Nashville, Tennessee was one of the finalists, ended up dropping out of the race. The state of Tennessee had offered, I think, $25 million or so in state tourism grants to help sweeten the deal here. We don't really have anything like that in Wisconsin, do we? Would you like to have seen more support from the state government?
No, there isn't something like that present in Milwaukee or in Wisconsin. It's going to be on the Republican National Committee's host committee, the local host committee, to raise those sort of funds. I believe that perhaps was the play from the state of Tennessee to help with the local host committee's fundraising efforts. My understanding is that, you know, the host committee here is primed and ready to host the convention and will do whatever they need to in order to raise the requisite amount of dollars. So I'll leave that to the host committee to do. I think that we've done our part here, but in terms of additional aids from the state, yeah, of course, in the city of Milwaukee, and not just here, but communities throughout the state, we need additional support generally from the state of Wisconsin.
Some of the groups already planning protests are making a partisan distinction here, saying, hey, Republicans, as they see it, don't serve the needs of the people of Milwaukee very well. How would you encourage people to cross the aisle there and have an open mind?
Well, a couple of things. Look, I think it's well documented that I'm not a Republican myself. I'm a Democrat. I'm proud to be a Democrat as well. And just because we play host to the Republican National Convention does not mean that anybody is signing up for the platform of the Republican Party. I certainly am not. But that doesn't mean that we can't be cordial or be welcoming or engage in a conversation with folks that we happen to disagree with. And for those folks that do have, you know, disagreements with the Republican Party or some of its candidates, look, with the fact that the convention is here in Milwaukee or will be here in Milwaukee, you'll have the largest microphone in the entire country to voice those to voice that opposition to the Republican Party and its platform. So that's a benefit for those folks who don't like the Republican platform, is that if they're based here in Milwaukee, they've got the opportunity to use their platform here to talk about that.
Now, the Democratic National Convention, again, was scheduled last time around for Milwaukee. Didn't end up happening as planned because of the pandemic. Do you plan on making a push to try to get them back and actually to hold a full-on convention too? Maybe get a double whammy?
Well, it's unlikely that you'll get two conventions in 1 year from the opposing parties. that's probably not going to happen. However, again, I think that us hosting the Republican National Convention here in Milwaukee in 2024 will show the Democrats what they missed out on in 2020 and get their attention for future conventions in the years ahead. So whether you're looking at 2028 or you know, years beyond that, I want for the Democratic National Convention, I want for all these other opportunities as well to take a look at Milwaukee. I'm tired of this city being in Chicago's shadow, being the best-kept secret. Let's be done with that. I certainly am. I want Milwaukee to shine, and having an opportunity to be on the national, the global stage in the center of the political universe, I think is a prime way to do that.
There's been a long-running conflict, I think, between leadership in Milwaukee and the state legislature, led now by Republicans, over, you know, how state funding goes to the city, fairly complicated issues. Are you hoping that this convention coming to town can be an opening for conversations about those issues?
Well, I ran on the need to improve the relationship between the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin. And I've been to the Capitol a number of times. I've had the highest ranking leaders in the legislature, both in the Assembly and in the Senate, here in the mayor's office. We've engaged them a number of times since, and we'll continue to do that. So I'm hopeful that the legislature will see that Milwaukee is actually a value added to the state of Wisconsin and will open the opportunity for Milwaukee to be able to increase revenue options, both in terms of revenues that are shared back from the state, a promise that the state government made to local governments way back in 1911 via shared revenue, and put Milwaukee in a position where, you know, we're not the only large city in America that does not have the ability to raise some local revenue outside of the property tax. You know, the benefit of having the RNC here for any Republican, doesn't matter at what level, is, look, you can't say that, you know, Milwaukee is, you know, a bad place or, you know, or any of those lines that we've heard before if we're willing to have and you'll take part in, you know, the Republican National Convention here in our city. And we've heard so many Republicans say this, is that this is a great city, and I totally concur. Now let's act like it, and let's make the investments in this city so we can be a benefit not just to the folks here and the businesses here, but to the rest of the state of Wisconsin as well. That's what I want to see.
Mayor Johnson, thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson with us today to talk about the Republican National Convention coming to Milwaukee in 2024, how the city's preparing, and the possible economic impact. We'll talk more about that convention and what it could mean for the economy and some concerns that it might not mean as much as some hope. That's coming up Wednesday at 4. Tomorrow on Central Time, are grown-ups taking the fun out of children's athletics? We'll talk to the author of the new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports. Hoping you'll join in with your experiences and perspectives. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Biden administration is talking about its recent accomplishments ahead of the midterm elections. We'll explore how recent bills and executive action could mobilize voters this November. First, four legal action groups filed a lawsuit against Governor Evers and members of the Wisconsin Public Defender Board last Tuesday. The Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and other groups behind the suit say the public defender system needs to be reformed as there's a backlog of about 35,000 pending criminal cases in the state of Wisconsin. That's causing those charged with criminal cases to wait weeks, sometimes months, for an appointed attorney. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by this backlog of cases, or do you know someone who has? Do you work in the criminal justice system? What are you seeing in courts in your neck of the woods? Do you see a need for changes in the state's public defender system? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ian Main is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. He teaches civil procedure, criminal procedure, civil rights, and race in the law. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob.
This is a problem a long time in the making. Before we dig into that history, what do you make of this lawsuit and what the plaintiffs are hoping to achieve here?
It's a really important lawsuit. It brings attention two ways. One, just publicly, like the conversation we're having today. So thank you to all the listeners, and I hope it generates more interest in what is an ongoing crisis. And then as to this, the legal aspect, it is a class action lawsuit that's asking permission to form as a class. The court is being asked to identify that there is a class here, and the class would be indigent individuals who have waited 14 days for an attorney after their initial appearance. And then should they prevail in the certification, what they're asking for is they'd like to, after 14 days, have it declared that in Wisconsin, if someone waits more than 14 days since their initial appearance, that's an indigent defendant, someone who cannot afford counsel, if one of those individuals waits more than 14 days, the lawsuit asked the court to declare that in Wisconsin to be unconstitutional, and that if the named defendants do not, therefore, thereafter, appoint someone immediately to represent that individual, that the charges against that individual would be dismissed with prejudice. So that's what the lawsuit is asking for.
That's going to strike, I think, a lot of people as drastic, saying, okay, 2 weeks and then we're dismissing potentially criminal charges. Can you talk about that expectation, though, of speedy justice?
Well, there, you know, that's interesting. I mean, the expectation, I guess, under the Constitution is reasonable. And you can read all the law journals you want on this and all the cases you want. You're not going to find a definition of what reasonable delay is. And so largely the U.S. Supreme Court leaves it to the states to, or even individual counties to determine what reasonable is. And so there's a lot of leeway. So as you're suggesting, I think what this lawsuit is doing is asking for a court, not a legislature, a court to declare what point is reasonable. And they're asking 14 days should be kind of the limit of what's reasonable to be appointed to counsel. And then the question is whether that is a drastic view. And I imagine there's debate on that. I certainly don't think it's drastic. I think there should be an immediate appointment of counsel. In fact, I think there should be the availability of counsel before the initial appearance. In many respects, although it's not constitutionally required, it is, from my perspective, a critical point in the litigation before charges are filed so that you can negotiate with a prosecutor or a DA before, like after the referral from the police department, but before the prosecutor actually charges the case. And we don't even have representation there. And so you'll have, you know, defendants languishing in jail for days without having any contact with a counsel because they have no constitutional right to one. When they finally have an initial appearance and they're given a bail amount, which they can't pay and therefore are subject to continued pretrial detention, then they're told that they have a right to an attorney, but one never shows up. And yet they're still sitting in jail. They could be losing their employment. Their family could be subject to eviction from their house. And then the statistics show us that those who are subject to pretrial detention from a public safety point of view, the statistics are sobering that a fair amount of individuals, that there's the longer you detain people on average raises their public safety risk. And therefore, what the statistics show is that people who are subject by and large to longer pretrial periods of detention have higher levels of recidivism. So, you know, when we talk about what's drastic or what's not drastic, we have to think about what it means from an individual point of view of a defendant subject to a state with immense powers, and yet you're alone, you're isolated, you're usually, you know, if you're put in jail, you're in a place that has all types of folks, many suffering serious mental illness, many who might have actually committed a serious crime, where you, the vast majority of folks in the situation of the class have not committed a serious crime, unless you think some kind of drug possession or selling drugs is really serious, but that's generally what we're looking at. And, you know, they're in a situation that's very unhealthy. They're cut off from the family. So it's terrifying. And so from my perspective, if you put me in a cage for a day and I'm not supposed to be there, that's a major trauma. And I'd want to file a lawsuit against anyone who does that to me. So if we don't view putting someone in jail as an act of violence, then yeah, it doesn't look drastic. If we accept this as normal, that we are continuing to put people without charges in the jail for sometimes over 3 or 4 months, in the kind of the terror of the situation that's created by the jail, then yeah, that's going to be a normalized thing, that's not drastic at all. But from my point of view, if you put me in a cage, that is a violent act. So I think it's a very, very important, critical incident that needs immediate treatment and intervention by a representative.
We're talking to UW-Madison law professor Ian Main about a lawsuit filed against the state's public defender system, saying there's a big backlog. It's keeping people in jail for a long time awaiting trial. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions. maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. And let's talk about how we got here. Why do we have such a shortage of people available to serve as public defenders here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in some respects, it's an easy answer. And in some respects, it's not. I mean, the easy part is you don't get paid. So if you're a public defender, you know, you get hired onto the public defender, probably starting around $50,000 in Wisconsin a year. And that's, you don't have overhead, right? You're given a salary. So that's where you are a state employee working for and supervised by the state public defender and the apparatus created by government. And those folks and public servants who do amazing work for the most part and are paid really very low for someone carrying the kind of debt that law people graduate from law school usually do, is they can only take so many cases. And there's lots of reasons for that. One, you know, these offices, both prosecutors' offices and criminal or public defender offices, in terms of how many people are there, it's remained pretty static over a long period of time. And yet we've seen a steady increase in the number of police in every county. And with that, you get more and more arrests. And with that, you get kind of a fire hose effect coming in from the prosecutor's office. The prosecutors can't review these cases as closely. It goes to the public defender to review, but they're inundated as well because they don't have the personnel to review all these cases. And so in one aspect, there's just a rising caseload problem because we don't have, there's not a commensurate increase in the number of prosecutors and defense attorneys when there's an increase in, say, the police presence. And so that creates a mismatch over time. That something's going to break. The other aspect is that there's a conflict. So there's conflicts in certain situations where the public defender can't take the case. Either it's another defendant who has a conflict with their own client and therefore has to be given an independent counsel. And that's called assigned counsel. About 40% generally, 40% of the cases in Wisconsin go to assigned counsel. These are individuals who are not supervised really by the state public defender. They're on a list. And they have discretion to take as many cases they want or as few as many or no cases at all. And they are paid at this point $70 an hour. And that, you know, if someone says, wait, $70 an hour, that's over 40 hour a week, that's $140,000 a year. And that's that kind of perception is what makes this really, really hard to navigate. Because in the end of the day, the people who are willing to serve as assigned counsel and pick up that 40% kind of cases that need to be picked up that can't be covered by the state public defender is dwindling and dwindling quickly. I served as an assigned counsel for about a year and a half in Wisconsin. I viewed it as a pro bono position in which I was volunteering my time in between two jobs. And I had a partner who made good money and therefore we as a kind of family unit decided it's okay for me to kind of do what we viewed as pro bono work. At that point I was paid $40 an hour and now it's $70 an hour. But when the public hears $70 an hour, they hear $70 an hour, but that's not even close to what it is. In fact, per hour, that's a billable hour. And a billable hour, hard to explain, but is about 1.8 hours. So what we're really talking about is if you're $70 per hour, that's really closer to $40 an hour. That doesn't take into consideration all the overhead, the office, the rent, the equipment, any personnel that you have, insurance, errors and omissions insurance. It doesn't take into bar fees. And it doesn't take into fact that there's a blended fee much lower if you're driving from point A to B. And of course, we heard about in the news a huge number of the need, a lot of the need is in rural areas, which means folks from Madison and Milwaukee have to drive to those places. And so, you know, there was a study in Indiana done by an agency in Indiana, and it had a similar kind of $70 in the range per hour rate for those assigned counsel. And they did a study asking 205 different attorneys who were assigned counsel making $70 a billable hour. They found that on average, that individual pulled in about $67,000 a year, and that overhead was around $50,000 plus other costs. So that and this is from an agency kind of report, those attorneys were making about $6 or $7 an hour.
We're talking to Ion Main, assistant professor at UW-Madison's Law School, looking at a lawsuit filed in an effort to reform the public defender system in the state. A big backlog there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. We'll continue the conversation. Get to your calls coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ion Main, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School, with us to talk about a lawsuit filed by four legal action groups saying a shortage of public defenders is unfair to many defendants in the court system. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Larry is with us in Kingston. Larry, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a son who is locked up now in Green Lake County Jail. He's a med-boarded, retired Green Beret weapons specialist. He did two tours in Iraq and two in Afghanistan, and they were going to send him to Africa, and he said he couldn't do it anymore. And he got med-boarded out of the service, but he's been around those burn piles and everything, and he's got mental health issues, PTSD, he's bipolar now. And about every 2 years, he decides to go off his medications, and he raises hell. And I called the police on him four times the last time he was home, part of the reason why he's in jail. But what I wonder is, why doesn't the VA pick these guys up that they know are messed up because of what they've seen and what they've done in war, and just pick them up and take them to the hospital that they need?
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. A little outside of your expertise there, I'm guessing, Ion, with the VA issue. But, Larry, and Larry, best to your family and your son. But to Larry's point about people with mental health problems, there's some of who we're talking about in this backlog in our jails now, right?
That's exactly right. And Larry, thank you for your call and thank you for your son's service. And I'm so sorry that's the way your son is being treated. I find that absolutely, a mistreatment of your son. And I have a lot of sympathy for what you're going through and what your son is going through. I do believe that we should have a public health response. I do not think that mental health kind of disruptions in one's mental health should be criminalized to the extent possible. And it goes to what I was saying before as well, is and this is different from your more important point, Larry, which is we definitely should have a kind of community resource response to, for example, episodes that, say, your son may have when understandably he goes off meds and he can be stabilized. And that's much less harm to society than putting him then in jail, which is creates even more kind of it's even more painful and harmful to your son, and has pretty bad outcomes for society. But this gets to the less important point, but also relevant to this case, or this lawsuit, is it's really important, I think, that the attorney gets in there really early, because if you get in there early as an attorney, I know that if I talk to, say, you, Larry, about your son's history, I can immediately go to the prosecutor and see if that there's some kind of programming and some kind of diversion or alternative that we might consider, rather than keeping your son in pretrial detention or punishing him for, especially after all his service, and when we're really talking about a mental health issue. So this issue is really important. We rely on our public defenders to do this kind of intervention. As Larry says, we should be relying on community resources or the VA or local resources. We aren't. We should be. But the next best thing is to get early intervention by a public defender or an assigned counsel.
Larry, thanks for that call. Tom joins us now in Madison. Tom, hello.
Good afternoon. Unfortunately, I think waiting for an attorney when you've committed a crime is a collateral consequence crime, and society will do its best to fix you up, but to say it has to happen within 2 weeks is ridiculous. Honestly, solution in within 2 weeks? Are they, you know, compensated for their medical injuries at the hands of a violent criminal?
Tom, thanks for the call. To Tom's first point, Ian, if somebody commits a crime, Tom feels they shouldn't have an expectation of representation in that two-week time window.
Yeah, and I understand Tom's perspective and appreciate it. And his focus on victims is important and on those who are subject to violence. And I also would support a much more robust kind of response from the state, county, and municipalities as to providing victims immediate support who have been subject to violent episodes. Many times, violent victims are left out of this discussion, left out of the process, are not part of this process, and kind of have to deal with their pain and trauma by themselves without support. There are counties that are starting to bring in more resources, which I applaud. And so I absolutely understand that piece, although I don't think it connects necessarily to how we treat defendant. I do think it's important that we give those kind of critical resources to victims. There's also an important aspect to put this in perspective, and violent crime is obviously something we should focus on and be cognizant of. But what happens too is that is the important tip of an iceberg. But there is an iceberg, and the iceberg involves a lot of what we call lifestyle crimes, whether this disorderly conduct, which gets close to violence, but is not drug kind of use, possession, selling, vandalism, being public disorder, whatever that might be. And so there's a lot of, and the vast majority of cases in which we are putting someone in detention, which again, if you don't think putting someone in a cage is violent, then we're just not on the same page. But I think it's an extreme situation that, you know, if the state says you have to go into a cage. And if we're going to do that, then we should make sure that the person has representation and that their rights are being respected and that that's where they should be versus that they've been that in fact they didn't commit the crime, that they've been, the charges are incorrect, that the person should not be detained for various reasons. There should be probation and they should be immediately released. And so we undo the kind of problems of creating unnecessarily unemployed individuals. That undermines public health and public safety. And so I think we have to look at this as a system. I think we do need to take care of our victims of violent crime, for sure. We have to keep our eye on the fact that the vast majority of crimes are not violent. And we have to actually give kind of the a fair kind of assessment of what we're actually doing to individuals when we send them to a jail and imprison them.
Thanks for that call. And Ian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
That's Ian Main, associate professor at UW-Madison Law School, who teaches civil procedure, criminal procedure, civil rights, and race and the law. Ian talked to us today about a lawsuit filed last Tuesday against the governor and members of the Wisconsin Public Defender Board in an effort to reform the public defender system, problem a long time in the making. You could still share your thoughts if you've had an experience with any part of this, been accused of a crime, a victim of a crime, and you've seen it take a long time to resolve. If you've worked as a public defender or a prosecutor, love to hear your story. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at recent action from the Biden administration on Congress on things like student loan debt, climate change, and firearms, and whether that might boost Democrats in the November midterm elections. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or by downloading the Wisconsin Public Radio app. And if you hear a great conversation that you want to share with somebody, you can do that with the archive feature, both online and on the app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.